Robbie brought the plates of ham to the table and he smiled at me, I think in gratitude. Now that we got our hackles down, what do you think of this hairdressing, beautician stuff? Papa said. You're not going to like what I think. How do you know if you don't say it? Well, okay. But I'm going to eat fast in case I have to run for it. I went through my beans and half my ham before I answered him. All right, I said. You've hit on a subject I've given a lot of thought to. I know quite a few women and girls, all ages, all kinds, all shapes, no two alike except in one thing. The hairdresser. It is my considered opinion that the hairdresser is the most influential man in any community.
You're making a joke.
I am not. I've made a deep study of this. When women go to the hairdresser, and they all do if they can afford it, something happens to them. They feel safe. They relax. They don't have to keep up any kind of pretense. The hairdresser knows what their skin is like under the makeup. He knows their age, their faceliftings. This being so, women tell a hairdresser things they wouldn't dare confess to a priest. And they are open about matters they'd try to conceal from a doctor.
You don't say.
I do say. I'll tell you, I'm a student of this. When women place their secret lives in the hairdresser's hands, he gains an authority few other men ever attain. I have heard hairdressers quoted with complete conviction in art, literature, politics, economics, child care, and morals.
I think you're kidding, but on the level.
I'm not smiling when I say it. I tell you that a clever, thoughtful, ambitious hairdresser wields a power beyond the comprehension of most men.
Jesus Christ! Did you hear that, Robbie? You know all that?
Some of it. Why, in the course I took, there was a whole section on psychology.
I never would have thought of it,
Papa said.
See?
How about a little drink?
Thanks, not tonight. My dog's not well. I'm going to push on early and try to find a vet.
Tell you what. Robbie will rig up a reading light for you. I'll leave the generator on. Will you want some breakfast?
I don't think so. I'm going to get an early start. When I came to my cabin after trying to help Charlie in his travail, Robbie was tying a trouble light to the iron frame of my sad bed. He said quietly,
Mister, I don't know if you believe all that you said, but you sure gave me a hand up.
You know, I think most of it might be true. If it is, that's a lot of responsibility, isn't it, Robbie?
It sure is, he said solemnly.
It was a restless night for me. I had rented a cabin not nearly as comfortable as the one I carried with me, and once installed, I had interfered in a matter that was none of my business. And while it is true that people rarely take action on advice of others unless they were going to do it anyway, there was the small chance that in my enthusiasm for my hairdressing thesis, I might have raised up a monster. In the middle of the night, Charlie awakened me with a soft, apologetic whining, and since he is not a whining dog, I got up immediately. He was in trouble. His abdomen distended and his nose and ears hot. I took him out and stayed with him, but he could not relieve the pressure. I wish I knew something of veterinary medicine. There's a feeling of helplessness with a sick animal. It can't explain how it feels. Though on the other hand, it can't lie, build up its symptoms, or indulge in the pleasures of hypochondria. I don't mean they are incapable of faking. Even Charlie, who is as honest as they come, is prone to limp when his feelings are hurt. I wish someone would write a good, comprehensive book of home dog medicine. I would do it myself, if I were qualified. Charlie was a really sick dog, and due to get sicker unless I could find some way to relieve the growing pressure. A catheter would do it, but who has one in the mountains in the middle of the night? I had a plastic tube for siphoning gasoline, but the diameter was too great. Then I remembered something about pressure causing muscular tension, which increases the pressure, etc., so that the first step is to relax the muscles. My medicine chest was not designed for general practice, but I did have a bottle of sleeping pills, Seconal,
1.5 grains. But how about dosage? That is where the home medicine book would be helpful. I took a capsule apart and unloaded half of it and fitted it together again. I slipped the capsule back beyond the bow in Charlie's tongue where he could not push it out, and then held his head up and massaged it down his throat. Then I lifted him on the bed and covered him. At the end of an hour, there was no change in him, so I opened a second capsule and gave him another half. I think that for his weight, 1.5 grains is a pretty heavy dose, but Charlie must have a high tolerance. He resisted it for 3/4 of an hour before his breathing slowed and he went to sleep. I must have dozed off, too. The next thing I knew, he hit the floor. In his drugged condition, his legs buckled under him. He got up, stumbled, and got up again. I opened the door and let him out. Well, the method worked all right, but I don't see how one medium-sized dog's body could have held that much fluid. Finally, he staggered in and collapsed on a piece of carpet and was asleep immediately. He was so completely out that I worried over the dosage. But his temperature had dropped, and his breathing was normal, and his heartbeat was strong and steady. My sleep was restless, and when dawn came, I saw that Charlie had not moved. I awakened him, and he was quite agreeable when I got his attention. He smiled, yawned, and went back to sleep. I lifted him into the cab and drove hell for leather for Spokane. I don't remember a thing about the country on the way. On the outskirts, I looked up a veterinary in the phone book, asked directions, and rushed Charlie into the examination room as an emergency. I shall not mention the doctor's name, but he is one more reason for a good home book on dog medicine. The doctor was, if not elderly, pushing his luck, but who am I to say he had a hangover? He raised Charlie's lip with a shaking hand, then turned up an eyelid and let it fall back.
"What's the matter with him?"
he asked, with no interest whatever. "That's why I'm here, to find out."
"Kinda dopey, old dog. Maybe he had a stroke."
"He had a distended bladder. If he's dopey, it's because I gave him 1.5 grains of Seconal."
"What for?"
"To relax him."
"Well, he's relaxed."
"Was the dosage too big?"
"I don't know."
"Well, how much would you give?"
"I wouldn't give it at all."
"Let's start fresh. What's wrong with him?"
"Probably a cold."
"Would that cause bladder symptoms?"
"If the cold was there, yes, sir."
"Well, look, I'm on the move. I'd like a little closer diagnosis."
He snorted. "Look here. He's an old dog. Old dogs get aches and pains. That's just the way it is."
I must have been snappish from the night. "So do old men," I said. "That doesn't keep them from doing something about it." And I think for the first time I got through to him.
"Give you something to flush out his kidneys," he said. "Just a cold."
I took the little pills and paid my bill and got out of there. It wasn't that this veterinary didn't like animals. I think he didn't like himself. And when that is so, the subject usually must find an area for dislike outside himself. Else he would have to admit his self-contempt. On the other hand, I yield to no one in my distaste for the self-styled dog lover, the kind who heaps up his frustrations and makes a dog carry them around. Such a dog lover talks baby talk to mature and thoughtful animals, and attributes his own sloppy characteristics to them until the dog becomes in his mind an alter ego. Such people, it seems to me, in what they imagine to be kindness, are capable of inflicting long and lasting tortures on an animal, denying it any of its natural desires and fulfillments until a dog of weak character breaks down and becomes the fat, asthmatic, befurred bundle of neuroses. When a stranger addresses Charlie in baby talk, Charlie avoids him. For Charlie is not a human, he's a dog. And he likes it that way. He feels that he is a first-rate dog and has no wish to be a second-rate human. When the alcoholic vet touched him with his unsteady, inept hand, I saw the look of veiled contempt in Charlie's eyes.
He knew about the man, I thought, and perhaps the doctor knew he knew. And maybe that was the man's trouble. It would be very painful to know that your patients had no faith in you. After Spokane, the danger of early snows had passed, for the air was changed and mulched by the strong breath of the Pacific. The actual time on the way from Chicago was short, but the overwhelming size and variety of the land, the many incidents and people along the way, had stretched time out of all bearing. For it is not true that an uneventful time in the past is remembered as fast. On the contrary, it takes the time stones of events to give a memory past dimension. Eventlessness collapses time. The Pacific is my home ocean. I knew it first, grew up on its shore, collected marine animals along the coast. I know its moods, its color, its nature. It was very far inland that I caught the first smell of the Pacific. When one has been long at sea, the smell of land reaches far out to greet one, and the same is true when one has been long inland. I believe I smelled the sea rocks and the kelp and the excitement of churning sea water, the sharpness of iodine and the underodor of washed and ground calcareous shells. Such a far-off and remembered odor comes subtly so that one does not consciously smell it, but rather an electric excitement is released, a kind of boisterous joy. I found myself plunging over the roads of Washington, as dedicated to the sea as any migrating lemming. I remembered lush and lovely eastern Washington very well in the noble Columbia River, which left its mark on Lewis and Clark. And while there were dams and power lines I hadn't seen, it was not greatly changed from what I remembered. It was only as I approached Seattle that the unbelievable change became apparent. Of course, I had been reading about the population explosion on the West Coast, but for West Coast, most people substitute California. People swarming in, cities doubling and trebling in numbers of inhabitants, while the fiscal guardians groan over the increasing weight of improvements and the need to care for a large new spate of indigents. It was here in Washington that I saw it first. I remembered Seattle as a town sitting on hills beside a matchless harborage, a little city of space and trees and gardens, its houses matched to such a background. It is no longer so. The tops of hills are shaved off to make level warrens for the rabbits of the present. The highways, 8 lanes wide, cut like glaciers through the uneasy land. This Seattle had no relation to the one I remembered. The traffic rushed with murderous intensity. On the outskirts of this place I once knew well, I could not find my way. Along what had been country lanes rich with berries, high wire fences and mile-long factories stretched, and the yellow smoke of progress hung over all. This sounds as though I bemoan an older time, which is the preoccupation of the old, or cultivate an opposition to change, which is the currency of the rich and stupid. It is not so. This Seattle was not something changed that I once knew. It was a new thing. Set down there not knowing it was Seattle, I could not have told where I was. Everywhere, frantic growth, a carcinomatous growth. Bulldozers rolled up the green forest and heaped the resulting trash for burning. The torn white lumber from concrete forms was piled beside gray walls. I wonder why progress looks so much like destruction. Next day I walked in the old part of Seattle, where the fish and crabs and shrimps lay beautifully on white beds of shaved ice, and where the washed and shining vegetables were arranged in pictures. I drank clam juice and ate the sharp crab cocktails that stands along the waterfront. It was not much changed, a little more run down and dingy than it was 20 years ago. And here a generality concerning the growth of American cities, seemingly true of all of them I know. When a city begins to grow and spread outward from the edges, the center, which was once its glory, is in a sense abandoned to time. Then the buildings grow dark and a kind of decay sets in. Poorer people move in as the rents fall, and small fringe businesses take the place of once flowering establishments. The district is still too good to tear down and too outmoded to be desirable. Besides, all the energy has flowed out to the new developments, to the semi-rural supermarkets, the outdoor movies, new houses with wide lawns and stucco schools where children are confirmed in their illiteracy. The old port with narrow streets and cobbled surfaces, smoke-grimed, goes into a period of desolation inhabited at night by the vague ruins of men, the lotus eaters who struggle daily toward unconsciousness by way of raw alcohol. Nearly every city I know has such a dying mother of violence and despair where at night the brightness of the street lamps is sucked away and policemen walk in pairs. And then one day, perhaps, the city returns and rips out the sore and builds a monument to its past. The rest during my stay in Seattle had improved Charlie's condition. I wondered whether in his advancing age the constant vibration of the truck might not have been the cause of his trouble. Quite naturally, as we moved down the beautiful coast, my method of travel was changed. Each evening I found a pleasant auto court to rest in, beautiful new places that have sprung up in recent years. Now, I began to experience a tendency in the West that perhaps I am too old to accept. It is the principle of do-it-yourself. At breakfast, a toaster is on your table. You make your own toast. When I drew into one of these gems of comfort and convenience, registered and was shown to my comfortable room after paying in advance, of course, that was the end of any contact with the management. There were no waiters, no bellboys. The chambermaids crept in and out invisibly. If I wanted ice, there was a machine near the office. I got my own ice, my own papers. Everything was convenient, centrally located, and lonesome. I lived in utmost luxury. Other guests came and went silently. If one confronted them with good evening, they looked a little confused and then responded, "Good evening." It seemed to me that they looked at me for a place to insert a coin. Somewhere in Oregon, on a rainy Sunday, the gallant Rosinante bespoke my attention. I have not spoken of my faithful vehicle except in formal terms of passing praise. Is it not always so? We value virtue, but do not discuss it. The honest bookkeeper, the faithful wife, the earnest scholar get little of our attention compared to the embezzler, the tramp, the cheat. If Rosinante had been neglected in this account, it is because she performed perfectly. Neglect did not extend to the mechanical, however. Meticulously, I changed the oil and attended to the greasing. I hate to see a motor neglected or mistreated or worked beyond its capacity. Rosinante responded to my kindness as she must, with purring motor and perfect performance. In only one thing I was thoughtless, or perhaps overzealous. I carried too much of everything. Too much food, too many books, tools enough to assemble a submarine. If I found sweet-tasting water, I filled her tank, and 30 gallons of water weigh 300 pounds. A spare container of butane gas, for safety's sake, weighs 75 pounds. Her springs were deeply depressed, but seemingly safe, and on hard-pitching roads I slowed and eased her through, and because of her ready goodness, I treated her like the honest bookkeeper, the faithful wife. I ignored her. And in Oregon, on a rainy Sunday, moving through an endless muddy puddle, a rear right tire blew out with a damp explosion. I have known and owned mean, ugly-natured cars which would have done this thing out of pure evil and malice, but not Rosinante. All in the day's work, I thought. That's the way the ball bounces. Well, this ball had bounced in 8 inches of muddy water, and the spare tire under the cab had been let down into the mud. The changing tools had been put away under the floor under the table so that my total load had to be unpacked. The new jack, never used and bright with factory paint, was stiff and unruly, and it was not designed for the overhang of Rosinante. I lay on my stomach and edged my way, swam my way under the truck, holding my nostrils clear of the surface of the water. The jack handle was slippery with greasy mud. Mud balls formed in my beard. I lay panting like a wounded duck, quietly cursing as I inched the jack forward under an axle that I had to find by feel, since it was underwater. Then, with superhuman gruntings and bubblings, my eyes starting from their sockets, I levered the great weight. I could feel my muscles tearing apart and separating from their anchoring bones. In actual time, not over an hour elapsed before I had the spare tire on. I was unrecognizable under many layers of yellow mud. My hands were cut and bleeding. I rolled a bad tire to a high place and inspected it. The whole side wall had blown out. Then I looked at the left rear tire, and to my horror saw a great rubber bubble on its side, and farther along another. It was obvious that the other tire might go at any moment, and it was Sunday, and it was raining, and it was Oregon. If the other tire blew, there we were, on a wet and lonesome road, having no recourse except to burst into tears and wait for death. And perhaps some kind birds might cover us with leaves. I peeled off mud and clothes together and changed to new finery, which got muddy in the process. No car has ever had such obsequious treatment as did Rosinante as we moved slowly on. Every irregularity in the road hurt me clear through. We crawled along at not more than 5 miles an hour, and that ancient law went into effect which says that when you need towns, they are very far apart. I needed more than a town. I needed two new heavy-duty rear tires. The man who had designed my truck had not anticipated the load I would carry. After 40 years in the painful wet desert with no cloud by day nor pillar of fire by night to guide us, we came to a damp little shut-up town whose name escapes me because I never learned it. Everything was closed, everything but one small service station. The owner was a giant with a scarred face and an evil white eye. If he were a horse, I wouldn't buy him. He was a mostly silent man.
"You got trouble," he said.
"You're telling me. Don't you sell tires?"
"Not your size. Have to send to Portland for those. Could phone tomorrow and get them maybe the next day."
"Isn't there any place in town that might have them?"
"There's two, both closed. I don't think they got that size. You're gonna need bigger tires."
He scratched his beard, peered long at the bubbles on the left rear, and poked them with a forefinger like a file. Finally he went into his little office, pushed a litter of brake linings and fan belts and catalogs aside, and from underneath dug out a telephone. And if ever my faith in the essential saintliness of humans becomes tattered, I shall think of that evil-looking man. After three calls, he found a dealer who had one of the kind and size required, but this man was tied up with a wedding and couldn't tear himself away. Three calls later, he turned up a rumor of another tire, but it was 8 miles away. The rain continued to fall. The process was endless because between each call there was a line of cars waiting to be filled with gas and oil. And all this had to be done with a stately slowness. A brother-in-law was finally aroused. He had a farm up the road a piece. He didn't want to get out in the rain, but my evil saint exerted some kind of pressure on him. That brother-in-law drove to two places far apart where the tires might be, found them, and brought them to me. In a little less than 4 hours, I was equipped, riding on big, heavy-duty tires of a kind that should have been there in the first place. I could have knelt in the mud and kissed the man's hands, but I didn't. I tipped him rather royally, and he said,
"You didn't ought to do that. Just remember one thing," he said. "Them new tires is bigger. They're going to change your speedometer reading. You'll be going faster than the needle says, and you get some itchy cop, why, he might pick you up."
I was so full of humble gratefulness, I could hardly speak. That happened on Sunday in Oregon, in the rain. And I hope that evil-looking service station man may live 1,000 years and people the earth with his offspring. Now, there is not any question that Charlie was rapidly becoming a tree expert of enormous background. He could probably get a job as a consultant with the Davies people. But from the first, I had withheld from him any information about the giant redwoods. It seemed to me that a Long Island poodle who had made his devoirs to Sequoia sempervirens or Sequoia gigantea might be set apart from other dogs. Might even be like that Galahad who saw the Grail. The concept is staggering. After this experience, he might be translated mystically to another plane of existence, to another dimension, just as the redwoods seem to be out of time and out of our ordinary thinking. The experience might even drive him mad. I had thought of that. On the other hand, it might make of him a consummate bore. A dog with an experience like that could become a pariah in the truest sense of the word. The redwoods, once seen, leave a mark or create a vision that stays with you always. No one has ever successfully painted or photographed a redwood tree. The feeling they produce is not transferable. From them comes silence and awe. It's not only their unbelievable stature nor the color which seems to shift and vary under your eyes. No, they are not like any trees we know. They are ambassadors from another time. They have the mystery of ferns that disappeared a million years ago into the coal of the Carboniferous era. They carry their own light and shade. The vainest, most slap-happy and irreverent of men, in the presence of redwoods, goes under a spell of wonder and respect. Respect. That's the word. Feels the need to bow to unquestioned sovereigns. I have known these great ones since my earliest childhood, have lived among them, camped and slept against their warm monster bodies, and no amount of association has bred contempt in me, and the feeling is not limited to me. A number of years ago, a newcomer, a stranger, moved to my country near Monterey. His senses must have been blunted and atrophied with money and the getting of it. He bought a grove of sempervirens in a deep valley near the coast, and then, as was his right by ownership, he cut them down and sold the lumber, and left on the ground the wreckage of his slaughter. Shock and numb outrage filled the town. This was not only murder, but sacrilege. We looked on that man with loathing, and he was marked to the day of his death. Of course, many of the ancient groves have been lumbered off, but many of the stately monuments remain and will remain for a good and interesting reason. States and governments could not buy and protect these holy trees. This being so, clubs, organizations, even individuals bought them and dedicated them to the future. I don't know any other similar case. Such is the impact of the sequoias on the human mind. But what would it be on Charlie? Approaching the redwood country in southern Oregon, I kept him in the back of Rocinante, hooded, as it were. I passed several groves and let them go as not quite adequate. And then on a level meadow, by a stream, we saw the grandfather, standing alone, 300 feet high and with the girth of a small apartment house. The branches with their flat, bright green leaves did not start below 150 feet up. Under that was the straight, slightly tapering column with its red to purple to blue. Its top was noble and lightning-riven by some ancient storm. I coasted off the road and pulled within 50 feet of the godlike thing, so close that I had to throw back my head and raise my eyes to vertical to see its branches. This was the time I had waited for. I opened the back door and let Charlie out and stood silently watching. For this could be dog's dream of heaven in the highest. Charlie sniffed and shook his collar. He sauntered to a weed, collaborated with a sapling, went to the stream and drank, then looked about for new things to do. "Charlie," I called, "look!" I pointed at the grandfather. He wagged his tail and took another drink. I said, "Of course, he doesn't raise his head high enough to see the branches to prove it's a tree." I strolled to him and raised his muzzle straight up. "Look, Charlie, it's the tree of all trees. It's the end of the quest." Charlie got a sneezing fit, as all dogs do when the nose is elevated too high. I felt the rage and hatred one has toward non-appreciators, toward those who, through ignorance, destroy a treasured plan. I dragged him to the trunk and rubbed his nose against it. He looked coldly at me. Gave me, and so to a hazelnut bush.
If I thought he did it out of spite or to make a joke, I said to myself, I'd kill him out of hand. I can't live without knowing.
I opened my pocket knife and moved to the creek side, where I cut a branch from a small willow tree. A Y branch, well tufted with leaves. I trimmed the branch ends neatly and finely sharpened the butt end. Then went to the serene grandfather of Titans and stuck the little willow in the earth so that its greenery rested against the shaggy redwood bark. Then I whistled to Charlie, and he responded amiably enough. I pointedly did not look at him. He cruised casually about until he saw the willow with a start of surprise. He sniffed its new-cut leaves delicately, and then, after turning this way and that to get range and trajectory, he fired. I stayed 2 days, close to the bodies of the giants, and there were no trippers, no chattering troops with cameras. There is a cathedral hush here. Perhaps the thick, soft bark absorbs sound and creates a silence. The trees rise straight up to zenith. There is no horizon. The dawn comes early and remains dawn until the sun is high. Then the green, fern-like foliage, so far up, strains the sunlight to a green gold and distributes it in shafts, or rather in stripes, of light and shade. After the sun passes zenith, it is afternoon and quickly evening, with a whispering dusk as long as was the morning. Thus time and the ordinary divisions of the day are changed. To me, dawn and dusk are quiet times, and here in the redwoods, nearly the whole of daylight is a quiet time. Birds move in the dim light or flash like sparks through the stripes of sun, but they make little sound. Underfoot is a mattress of needles deposited for over 2,000 years. No sound of footsteps can be heard on this thick blanket. To me, there's a remote and cloistered feeling here. One holds back speech for fear of disturbing something. What? From my earliest childhood, I've felt that something was going on in the groves, something of which I was not a part. And if I had forgotten the feeling, I soon got it back. At night, the darkness is black, only straight up a patch of gray and an occasional star. And there's a breathing in the black. For these huge things that control the day and inhabit the night are living things and have presence and perhaps feeling and, somewhere in deep down perception, perhaps communication. I have had lifelong association with these things. Odd that the word trees does not apply. I can accept them and their power and their age because I was early exposed to them. On the other hand, people lacking such experience begin to have a feeling of uneasiness here, of danger, of being shut in, enclosed and overwhelmed. It is not only the size of these redwoods, but their strangeness that frightens them. And why not? For these are the last remaining members of a race that flourished over 4 continents, as far back in geologic time as the Upper Jurassic period. Fossils of these ancients have been found dating from the Cretaceous era, while in the Eocene and Miocene they were spread over England and Europe and America. And then the glaciers moved down and wiped the Titans out beyond recovery. And only these few are left. A stunning memory of what the world was like once, long ago. Can it be that we do not love to be reminded that we are very young and callow in a world that was old when we came into it? And could there be a strong resistance to the certainty that a living world will continue its stately way when we no longer inhabit it? I find it difficult to write about my native place, Northern California. It should be the easiest, because I knew that strip angled against the Pacific better than any place in the world. But I find it not one thing, but many, one printed over another until the whole thing blurs. What it is warped with memory of what it was, and that with what happened there to me. The whole bundle racked until objectiveness is nigh impossible. This 4-lane concrete highway slashed with speeding cars, I remember, is a narrow, twisting mountain road where the wood teams moved, drawn by steady mules. They signaled their coming with the high, sweet jangle of hay bells.
This was a little town. A general store under a tree and a blacksmith shop and a bench in front on which to sit and listen to the clang of hammer on anvil. Now, little houses, each one like the next, particularly since they try to be different, spread for a mile in all directions. That was a woody hill with live oaks dark green against the parched grass, where the coyotes sang on moonlit nights. The top is shaved off and a television relay station lunges at the sky and feeds a nervous picture to thousands of tiny houses clustered like aphids beside the roads. And isn't this the typical complaint? I have never resisted change, even when it has been called progress, and yet I felt resentment toward the strangers swamping what I thought of as my country with noise and clutter and the inevitable rings of junk. And of course these new people will resent the newer people. I remember how when I was a child we responded to the natural dislike of the stranger. We who were born here and our parents also felt a strange superiority over newcomers, barbarians, forestieri, and they, the foreigners, resented us and even made a rude poem about us. The miner came in 49, the whores in 51, and when they got together, they made a native son. And we were an outrage to the Spanish Mexicans, and they, in their turn, on the Indians. Could that be why the sequoias make folks nervous? Those natives were grown trees when a political execution took place on Golgotha. They were well toward middle age when Caesar destroyed the Roman Republic in the process of saving it. To the sequoias, everyone is a stranger, a barbarian. Sometimes the view of change is distorted by a change in oneself. The room which seems so large is shrunk. The mountain has become a hill. But this is no illusion in this case. I remember Salinas, the town of my birth, when it proudly announced 4,000 citizens. Now it is 80,000 and leaping pell-mell on in a mathematical progression, 100,000 in 3 years and perhaps 200,000 in 10, with no end in sight. Even those people who joy in numbers and are impressed with bigness are beginning to worry, gradually becoming aware that there must be a saturation point, and the progress may be a progression toward strangulation. And no solution has been found. You can't forbid people to be born. At least not yet. I spoke earlier of the emergence of the trailer home, the mobile unit, and of certain advantages to their owners. I had thought there were many of them in the East and Middle West, but California spawns them like herrings. The trailer courts are everywhere, lapping up the sides of hills, spilling into riverbeds. And they bring with them a new problem. These people partake of all the local facilities, the hospitals, the schools, police protection, welfare programs, and so far they do not pay taxes. Local facilities are supported by real estate taxes, from which the mobile home is immune. It is true that the state imposes a license fee, but that fee does not come to the counties or the towns except for road maintenance and extension. Thus, the owners of immovable property find themselves supporting swarms of guests, and they are getting pretty angry about it. But our tax laws and the way we think about them were long developing. The mind shies away from a head tax, a facility tax. The concept of real property is deeply implanted in us as the source and symbol of wealth. And now a vast number of people have found a way to bypass it. This might be applauded, since we generally admire those who can escape taxes, were it not that the burden of this freedom falls with increasing weight on others. It is obvious that within a very short time, a whole new method of taxation will have to be devised, else the burden on real estate will be so great that no one will be able to afford it. Far from being a source of profit, ownership will be a penalty, and this will be the apex of a pyramid of paradoxes. We have in the past been forced into reluctant change by weather, calamity, and plague. Now the pressure comes from our biologic success as a species. We have overcome all enemies but ourselves. When I was a child growing up in Salinas, we called San Francisco the city. Of course, it was the only city we knew, but I still think of it as the city, and so does everyone else who has ever associated with it. A strange and exclusive word is city.
Besides San Francisco, only small sections of London and Rome stay in the mind as the city. New Yorkers say they are going to town. Paris has no title, but Paris, Mexico City, is the capital. Once I knew the city very well, spent my attic days there while others were being a lost generation in Paris. I fledged in San Francisco, climbed its hills, slept in its parks, worked on its docks, marched and shouted in its revolt. In a way, I felt I owned the city as much as it owned me. San Francisco put on a show for me. I saw her across the bay from the great road that bypasses Sausalito and enters the Golden Gate Bridge. The afternoon sun painted her white and gold, rising on her hills like a noble city in a happy dream. A city on hills has it over flatland places. New York makes its own hills with craning buildings, but this gold and white acropolis, rising wave on wave against the blue of the Pacific sky, was a stunning thing. A painted thing. Like a picture of a medieval Italian city which can never have existed. I stopped in a parking place to look at her and the necklace bridge over the entrance from the sea that led to her. Over the green, higher hills to the south, the evening fog rolled like herds of sheep coming to coat in the golden city. I've never seen her more lovely. When I was a child and we were going to the city, I couldn't sleep for several nights before out of bursting excitement. She leaves a mark. Then I crossed the great arch hung from filaments, and I was in the city I knew so well. It remained the city I remembered, so confident of its greatness that it can afford to be kind. It had been kind to me in the days of my poverty, and it did not resent my temporary solvency. I might have stayed indefinitely, but I had to go to Monterey to send off my absentee ballot. In my young days in Monterey County, 100 miles south of San Francisco, everyone was a Republican. My family was Republican. I might still be one if I'd stayed there. President Harding stirred me toward the Democratic Party, and President Hoover cemented me there. If I indulge in personal political history, it is because I think my experience may not be unique. I arrived in Monterey, and the fight began. My sisters are still Republicans. Civil War is supposed to be the bitterest of wars, and surely family politics are the most vehement and venomous. I can discuss politics coldly and analytically with strangers. That was not possible with my sisters. We ended each session panting and spent with rage. On no point was there any compromise. No quarter was asked or given. Each evening we promised, "Let's just be friendly and loving. No politics tonight." And 10 minutes later, we would be screaming at each other. "John Kennedy was a so-and-so." "Well, if that's your attitude, how can you reconcile Dick Nixon?" "Now, let's be calm. We're reasonable people. Let's explore this." "I have explored it. How about the Scotch whiskey?" "Oh, if you take that line, how about the grocery in Santa Ana? How about Checkers, my beauty?" "Father would turn in his grave if he heard you." "No, don't bring him in, because he would be a Democrat today." "Listen to you. Bobby Kennedy is out buying sacks full of votes." "You mean no Republican ever bought a vote? Don't make me laugh." It was bitter, and it was endless. We dug up obsolete convention weapons and insults to hurl back and forth. "You talk like a communist." "Well, you sound suspiciously like Genghis Khan." It was awful. A stranger hearing us would have called the police to prevent bloodshed. And I don't think we were the only ones. I believe this was going on all over the country in private. It must have been only publicly that the nation was tongue-tied. The main purpose of this homecoming seemed to be fighting over politics, but in between I visited old places. There was a touching reunion in Johnny Garcia's bar in Monterey, with tears and embraces, speeches and endearments in the poco Spanish of my youth. There were Jolon Indians I remembered as shirt-tailed chamacos. The years rolled away. We danced formally, hands locked behind us, and we sang the Southern County Anthem. "There was a young guy from Jolon, got sick from leaving Jolon. He went to Kin City to got something pretty, puta chingada cabron." I hadn't heard it in years. It was old home week. The years crawled back in their holes. It was the Monterey where they used to put a wild bull and a grizzly bear in the ring together, a place of sweet and sentimental violence, and a wise innocence as yet unknown and therefore undirtied by undiapered minds. We sat at the bar, and Johnny Garcia regarded us with his tear-blown Gallego eyes. His shirt was open, and a gold medal on a chain hung at his throat. He leaned close over the bar and said to the nearest man,
"Look at it. Juanito here gave it to me years ago, brought it from Mexico. La Morena, la Virgencita de Guadalupe. And look," he turned the gold oval, "my name and his."
I said, "Scratched with a pin."
"I have never taken it off," said Johnny.
A big dark paisano I didn't know stood on the rail and leaned over the bar.
"Favor?"
he asked, and without looking, Johnny extended the medal. The man kissed it and said,
"Gracias,"
and went quickly out through the swinging doors. Johnny's chest swelled with emotion and his eyes were wet.
"Juanito," he said, "come home. Come back to your friends. We love you. We need you. This is your seat, compadre. Do not leave it vacant."
I must admit I felt the old surge of love and oratory, and I haven't a drop of Galician blood. "Cuñado mío," I said sadly, "I live in New York now."
"I don't like New York," Johnny said.
"You've never been there."
"I know, that's why I don't like it. You have to come back. You belong here."
I drank deeply, and darned if I didn't find myself making a speech. The old words unused for so long came rattling back to me. "Let your heart have ears, my uncle, my friend. We are not baby skunks, you and I. Time has settled some of our problems."
"Silence," he said. "I will not hear it. It is not true. You still love wine? You still love girls? What has changed? I know you. No me cagas, niño."
"Te cago nunca." There was a great man named Thomas Wolfe, and he wrote a book called You Can't Go Home Again, and that is true.
"Liar," said Johnny. "This is your cradle, your home."
Suddenly, he hit the bar with the oaken indoor ball bat he used in arguments to keep the peace.
"In the fullness of time, maybe 100 years, this should be your grave."
The bat fell from his hand, and he wept at the prospect of my future demise. I puddled up at the prospect myself. I gazed at my empty glass. "These Gallegos have no manners."
"Oh, for God's sake," Johnny said. "Oh, forgive me."
And he filled us up. The lineup at the bar was silent now, dark faces with a courteous lack of expression.
"To your homecoming, compadre," Johnny said. "John the Baptist, get the hell out of those potato chips."
"Conejo de mi alma," I said. "Rabbit of my soul, hear me out." The big dark one came in from the street, leaned over the bar and kissed Johnny's medal, and went out again. I said irritably, "There was a time when a man could be listened to. Must I buy a ticket? Must I make a reservation to tell a story?" Johnny turned to the silent bar.
"Silence!"
he said fiercely, and took up his indoor ball bat. "I will now tell you true things, brother-in-law. Step into the street. Strangers, foreigners, thousands of them. Look to the hills, a pigeon loft. Today I walked the length of Alvarado Street and back by the Calle Principal, and I saw nothing but strangers. This afternoon I got lost in Peter's Gate. I went to the Field of Love, back of Joe Duckworth's house by the ballpark. It's a used car lot. My nerves are jangled by traffic lights. Even the police are strangers, foreigners. I went to the Carmel Valley, where once we could shoot a 30-30 in any direction. Now you couldn't shoot a marble knuckles down without wounding a foreigner. And Johnny, I don't mind people, you know that. But these are rich people. They plant geraniums in big pots, swimming pools where frogs and crayfish used to wait for us. No, my goatly friend, if this were my home, would I get lost in it? If this were my home, could I walk the streets and hear no blessing?" Johnny was slumped casually over the bar.
But here, Juanito, it's the same. We don't let them in.
I looked down the line of faces. Yes, here it is better. But can I live on a bar stool? Let us not fool ourselves. What we knew is dead. And maybe the greatest part of what we were is dead. What's out there is new and perhaps good, but it's nothing we know. Johnny held his temples between his cupped hands and his eyes were bloodshot. Where are the great ones? Tell me, where's Willie Tripp?
Dead?
Johnny said hollowly.
Where is Pion, Charlie, Pom Pom, Miss Gregg, Stevie Field?
Dead, 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 he echoed. Ed Ricketts, Whitey's number one and two, where's Sonny Boy? Ankle Varney, Jesus Maria Corcoran, Joe Portigee, Shorty Lee, Flora Wood, and that girl who kept spiders in her hat.
Dead. All dead, Johnny moaned. It's like we was in a bucket of ghosts, said Johnny.
No, they're not true ghosts. We're the ghosts. The big dark one came in and Johnny held out his medal for kissing without being asked. Johnny turned and walked with widespread legs back to the bar mirror. He studied his face for a moment, picked up a bottle, took out the cork, smelled it, tasted it. Then he looked at his fingernails. There was a stir of restlessness along the bar. Shoulders hunched, legs were uncrossed. There's going to be trouble, I said to myself. Johnny came back and delicately set the bottle on the bar between us. His eyes were wide and dreamy. Johnny shook his head.
I guess you don't like us anymore. I guess maybe you're too good for us.
His fingertips played slow chords on an invisible keyboard on the bar. For just a moment, I was tempted. I heard the wail of trumpets and the clash of arms. But hell, I'm too old for it. I made the door in two steps. I turned. Why does he kiss your medal?
He's placing bets.
Okay. See you tomorrow, Johnny. The double door swung to behind me. I was on Alvarado Street, slashed with neon light. And around me, it was nothing but strangers. In my flurry of nostalgic spite, I have done the Monterey Peninsula a disservice. It is a beautiful place, clean, well-run, and progressive. The beaches are clean where once they've festered with fish guts and flies. The canneries, which once put up a sickening stench, are gone. Their places filled with restaurants, antique shops, and the like. They fish for tourists now, not pilchards, and that species they are not likely to wipe out. And Carmel, begun by starveling writers and unwanted painters, is now a community of the well-to-do and the retired. If Carmel's founders should return, they could not afford to live there, but it wouldn't go that far. They would be instantly picked up as suspicious characters and deported over the city line. The place of my origin had changed, and having gone away, I had not changed with it. In my memory, it stood as it once did, and its outward appearance confused and angered me. What I am about to tell must be the experience of very many in this nation where so many wander and come back. I called on old and valued friends. I thought their hair had receded a little more than mine. The greetings were enthusiastic, the memories flooded up, old crimes and old triumphs were brought out and dusted. And suddenly my attention wandered, and looking at my ancient friend, I saw that his wandered also. And it was true, what I had said to Johnny Garcia. I was the ghost. My town had grown and changed, and my friend along with it, now returning. As changed to my friend as my own town was to me, I distorted his picture, muddied his memory. When I went away, I had died, and so became fixed and unchangeable. My return caused only confusion and uneasiness. Although they could not say it, my old friends wanted me gone, so that I could take my proper place in the pattern of remembrance. And I wanted to go for the same reason. Tom Wolfe was right. You can't go home again, because home has ceased to exist except in the mothballs of memory. My departure was flight, but I did do one formal and sentimental thing before I turned my back. I drove up to Fremont's Peak, the highest point for many miles around. I climbed the last spiky rocks to the top. Here, among these blackened granite outcrops, General Fremont made his stand against a Mexican army and defeated it. When I was a boy, we occasionally found cannonballs and rusted bayonets in the area. This solitary stone peak overlooks the whole of my childhood and youth. The great Salinas Valley, stretching south for nearly 100 miles. The town of Salinas, where I was born, now spreading like crabgrass toward the foothills. Mount Toro, on the Brother Range to the west, was a rounded benign mountain, and to the north, Monterey Bay shone like a blue platter. I felt and smelled and heard the wind blow up from the long valley. It smelled of the brown hills of wild oats. I remembered how once, in that part of youth that is deeply concerned with death, I wanted to be buried on this peak where, without eyes, I could see everything I knew and loved. For in those days, there was no world beyond the mountains. And I remembered how intensely I felt about my interment. It is strange, and perhaps fortunate, that when one's time grows nearer, one's interest in it flags, as death becomes a fact rather than a pageantry. Here on these high rocks, my memory myth repaired itself. Charlie, having explored the area, sat at my feet, his fringed ears blowing like laundry on a line. His nose, moist with curiosity, sniffed the windborne pattern of 100 miles. "You wouldn't know, my Charlie, that right down there in that little valley, I fished for trout with your namesake, my Uncle Charlie. And over there, see where I'm pointing? My mother shot a wildcat. Straight down there, 40 miles away, our family ranch was. Old Starvation Ranch. Can you see that darker place there? Well, that's a tiny canyon, with a clear and lovely stream bordered with wild azaleas and fringed with big oaks. And on one of those oaks, my father burned his name with a hot iron, together with the name of the girl he loved. In the long years, the bark grew over the burn and covered it. And just a little while ago, a man cut that oak for firewood, and his splitting wedge uncovered my father's name, and the man sent it to me. In the spring, Charlie, when the valley is carpeted with blue lupins like a flowery sea, there's a smell of heaven up here. The smell of heaven. I printed it once more on my eyes, south, west, and north. And then we hurried away from the permanent and changeless past where my mother is always shooting a wildcat and my father is always burning his name with his love. It would be pleasant to be able to say of my travels with Charlie, I went out to find the truth about my country and I found it. And then it would be such a simple matter to set down my findings and lean back comfortably with a fine sense of having discovered truths and taught them to my readers. I wish it were that easy. But what I carried in my head and deeper in my perceptions was a barrel of worms. I discovered long ago in collecting and classifying marine animals that what I found was closely intermeshed with how I felt at the moment. External reality has a way of being not so external after all. This monster of a land, this mightiest of nations, this spawn of the future turns out to be the macrocosm of microcosm me. If an Englishman or a Frenchman or an Italian should travel my route, see what I saw, hear what I heard, their stored pictures would be not only different from mine, but equally different from one another. If other Americans reading this account should feel it true, that agreement would only mean that we are alike in our Americanness. From start to finish, I found no strangers. If I had, I might be able to report them more objectively. But these are my people, and this is my country. If I found matters to criticize and to deplore, they were tendencies equally present in myself. If I were to prepare one immaculately inspected generality, it would be this. For all of our enormous geographic range,
for all of our sectionalism, for all of our interwoven breeds drawn from every part of the ethnic world, we are a nation.